This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Jack Sundrud. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 19. We have seen that one of his first acts after he became king was to recall Ormond from Ireland. Ormond was the head of the English interest in that kingdom. He was firmly attached to the Protestant religion, and his power far exceeded that of an ordinary Lord Lieutenant. First, because he was in rank and wealth the greatest of the colonists, and secondly, because he was not only the chief of the civil administration, but also commander of the forces. The king was not at that time disposed to commit the government wholly to Irish hands. He had indeed been heard to say that a native viceroy would soon become an independent sovereign. For the present, therefore, he determined to divide the power which Ormond had possessed, to entrust the civil administration to an English and Protestant Lord Lieutenant, and to give the command of the army to an Irish and Roman Catholic general. The Lord Lieutenant was Clarendon. The general was Tyrconnell. Tyrconnell sprang, as has already been said, from one of those degenerate families of the Pale, which were popularly classed with the aboriginal population of Ireland. He sometimes, indeed, in his rants, talked with Norman haughtiness of the Celtic barbarians, but all his sympathies were really with the natives. The Protestant colonists he hated, and they returned his hatred. Clarendon's inclinations were very different, but he was, from temper, interest, and principle, an obsequious courtier. His spirit was mean, his circumstances were embarrassed, and his mind had been deeply imbued with the political doctrines which the Church of England had, in that age, too assiduously taught. His abilities, however, were not contemptible, and under a good king he would probably have been a respectable viceroy. About 3/4 of a year elapsed between the recall of Ormond and the arrival of Clarendon at Dublin. During that interval, the king was represented by a board of Lords Justices, but the military administration was in Tyrconnell's hands. Already the designs of the court began gradually to unfold themselves. A royal order came from Whitehall for disarming the population. This order Tyrconnell strictly executed as respected the English. Though the country was infested by predatory bands, a Protestant gentleman could scarcely obtain permission to keep a brace of pistols. The native peasantry, on the other hand, were suffered to retain their weapons. The joy of the colonists was therefore great when at length in December 1685 Tyrconnell was summoned to London and Clarendon set out for Dublin. But it soon appeared that the government was really directed not at Dublin, but in London. Every mail that crossed St. George's Channel brought tidings of the boundless influence which Tyrconnell exercised on Irish affairs. It was said that he was to be a marquis, that he was to be a duke, that he was to have the command of the forces, that he was to be entrusted with the task of remodeling the army and the courts of justice. Clarendon was bitterly mortified at finding himself a subordinate, a member of that administration of which he had expected to be the head. He complained that whatever he did was misrepresented by his detractors, and that the gravest resolutions touching the country which he governed were adopted at Westminster, made known to the public, discussed at coffee houses, communicated in hundreds of private letters, some weeks before one hint had been given to the Lord Lieutenant. His own personal dignity, he said, mattered little. But it was no light thing that the representative of the majesty of the throne should be made an object of contempt to the people. Panic spread fast among the English when they found that the viceroy, their fellow countryman and fellow Protestant, was unable to extend to them the protection which they had expected from him. They began to know by bitter experience what it is to be a subject caste. They were harassed by the natives with accusations of treason and sedition. This Protestant had corresponded with Monmouth. That Protestant had said something disrespectful of the king 4 or 5 years ago, when the exclusion bill was under discussion, and the evidence of the most infamous of mankind was ready to substantiate every charge. The Lord Lieutenant expressed his apprehension that if these practices were not stopped, there would soon be at Dublin a reign of terror similar to that which he had seen in London, when every man held his life and honor at the mercy of Oates and Bedloe. Clarendon was soon informed by a concise dispatch from Sunderland, that it had been resolved to make without delay a complete change in both the civil and the military government of Ireland, and to bring a large number of Roman Catholics instantly into office. His Majesty, it was most ungraciously added, had taken counsel on these matters with persons more competent to advise him than his inexperienced Lord Lieutenant could possibly be. Before this letter reached the Viceroy, the intelligence which it contained had, through many channels, arrived in England. The terror of the colonists was extreme. Outnumbered as they were by the native population, their condition would be pitiable indeed if the native population were to be armed against them with the whole power of the state, and nothing less than this was threatened. The English inhabitants of Dublin passed each other in the streets with dejected looks. On the exchange, business was suspended. Landowners hastened to sell their estates for whatever could be got, and to remit the purchase money to England. Traders began to call in their debts and to make preparations for retiring from business. The alarm soon affected the revenue. Clarendon attempted to inspire the dismayed settlers with a confidence which he was himself far from feeling. He assured them that their property would be held sacred, and that to his certain knowledge the king was fully determined to maintain the act of settlement which guaranteed their right to the soil. But his letters to England were in a very different strain. He ventured even to expostulate with the king and, without blaming His Majesty's intention of employing Roman Catholics, expressed a strong opinion that the Roman Catholics who might be employed should be Englishmen. The reply of James was dry and cold. He declared that he had no intention of depriving the English colonists of their land, but that he regarded a large portion of them as his enemies, and that since he consented to leave so much property in the hands of his enemies, it was the more necessary that the civil and military administration should be in the hands of his friends. Accordingly, several Roman Catholics were sworn of the Privy Council, and orders were sent to corporations to admit Roman Catholics to municipal advantages. Many officers of the army were arbitrarily deprived of their commissions and of their bread. It was to no purpose that the Lord Lieutenant pleaded the cause of some whom he knew to be good soldiers and loyal subjects. Among them were old cavaliers who had fought bravely for monarchy, and who bore the marks of honorable wounds. Their places were supplied by men who had no recommendation but their religion. Of the new captains and lieutenants, it was said, some had been cowherds, some footmen, some noted marauders, some had been so used to wear brogues that they stumbled and shuffled about strangely in their military jackboots. Not a few of the officers who were discarded took refuge in the Dutch service, and enjoyed, 4 years later, the pleasure of driving their successors before them in ignominious rout through the waters of the Boyne. The distress and alarm of Clarendon were increased by news which reached him through private channels. Without his approbation, without his knowledge, preparations were making for arming and drilling the whole Celtic population of the country of which he was the nominal governor. Tyrconnell from London directed the design, and the prelates of his church were his agents. Every priest had been instructed to prepare an exact list of all his male parishioners capable of bearing arms, and to forward it to his bishop. It had already been rumored that Tyrconnell would soon return to Dublin armed with extraordinary and independent powers, and the rumor gathered strength daily. The Lord Lieutenant, whom no insult could drive to resign the pomp and emoluments of his place, declared that he should submit cheerfully to the royal pleasure, and approve himself in all things a faithful and obedient subject. He had never, he said, in his life, had any difference with Tyrconnell, and he trusted that no difference would now arise. Clarendon appears not to have recollected that there had once been a plot to ruin the fame of his innocent sister, and that in that plot Tyrconnell had borne a chief part. This is not exactly one of the injuries which high-spirited men most readily pardon. But in the wicked court where the Hydes had long been pushing their fortunes, such injuries were easily forgiven and forgotten, not from magnanimity or Christian charity, but from mere baseness and want of moral sensibility. In June 1686, Tyrconnell came. His commission authorized him only to command the troops, but he brought with him royal instructions touching all parts of the administration, and at once took the real government of the island into his own hands. On the day after his arrival, he explicitly said that commissions must be largely given to Roman Catholic officers, and that room must be made for them by dismissing more Protestants. He pushed on the remodeling of the army eagerly and indefatigably. It was indeed the only part of the functions of a commander-in-chief which he was competent to perform, for though courageous in brawls and duels, he knew nothing of military duty. At the very first review which he held, it was evident to all who were near to him that he did not know how to draw up a regiment. To turn Englishmen out and to put Irishmen in was, in his view, the beginning and the end of the administration of war. He had the insolence to cashier the captain of the Lord Lieutenant's own bodyguard, nor was Clarendon aware of what had happened till he saw a Roman Catholic whose face was quite unknown to him, escorting the state coach. The change was not confined to the officers alone. The ranks were completely broken up and recomposed. 400 or 500 soldiers were turned out of a single regiment chiefly on the grounds that they were below the proper stature. Yet the most unpracticed eye at once perceived that they were taller and better made men than their successors, whose wild and squalid appearance disgusted the beholders. Orders were given to the new officers that no man of the Protestant religion was to be suffered to enlist. The recruiting parties, instead of beating their drums for volunteers at fairs and markets, as had been the old practice, repaired the places to which the Roman Catholics were in the habit of making pilgrimages for purposes of devotion. In a few weeks the general had introduced more than 2,000 natives into the ranks, and the people about him confidently affirmed that by Christmas Day not a man of English race would be left in the whole army. On all questions which arose in the Privy Council, Tyrconnell showed similar violence and partiality. John Keating, Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, a man distinguished by ability, integrity, and loyalty, represented with great mildness that perfect equality was all that the general could reasonably ask for his own church. The king, he said, evidently meant that no man fit for public trust should be excluded because he was a Roman Catholic, and that no man unfit for public trust should be admitted because he was a Protestant. Tyrconnell immediately began to curse and swear, "I do not know what to say to that. I would have all Catholics in." The most judicious Irishmen of his own religious persuasion were dismayed at his rashness and ventured to remonstrate with him, but he drove them from him with imprecations. His brutality was such that many thought him mad, yet it was less strange than the shameless volubility with which he uttered falsehoods. He had long before earned the nickname of Lying Dick Talbot, and at Whitehall any wild fiction was commonly designated as one of Dick Talbot's truths. He now daily proved that he was well entitled to this unenviable reputation. Indeed, in him, mendacity was almost a disease. He would, after giving orders for the dismission of English officers, take them into his closet, assure them of his confidence and friendship, and implore heaven to confound him, sink him, blast him, if he did not take good care of their interests. Sometimes those to whom he had thus perjured himself learned, before the day closed, that he had cashiered them. On his arrival, though, he swore savagely at the act of settlement, and called the English interest a foul thing, a roguish thing, and a damned thing. He yet intended to be convinced that the distribution of property could not, after the lapse of so many years, be altered. But when he had been a few weeks at Dublin, his language changed. He began to harangue vehemently at the council board on the necessity of giving back the land to the old owners. He had not, however, as yet obtained his master's sanction to this fatal project. National feeling still struggled feebly against superstition in the mind of James. He was an Englishman. He was an English king, and he could not without some misgivings consent to the destruction of the greatest colony that England had ever planted. The English Roman Catholics with whom he was in the habit of taking counsel were almost unanimous in favor of the act of settlement. Not only the honest and moderate Powis, but the dissolute and headstrong Dover gave judicious and patriotic advice. Tyrconnell could hardly hope to counteract at a distance the effect which such advice must produce on the royal mind. He determined to plead the cause of his caste in person, and accordingly he set out, at the end of August, for England. His presence and his absence were equally dreaded by the Lord Lieutenant. It was, indeed, painful to be daily browbeaten by an enemy, but it was not less painful to know that an enemy was daily breathing calumny and evil counsel in the royal ear. Clarendon was overwhelmed by manifold vexations. He made a progress through the country and found that he was everywhere treated by the Irish population with contempt. The Roman Catholic priests exhorted their congregations to withhold from him all marks of honor. The native gentry, instead of coming to pay their respects to him, remained at their houses. The native peasantry everywhere sang Erse songs in praise of Tyrconnell, who would, they doubted not, soon reappear to complete the humiliation of their oppressors. The viceroy had scarcely returned to Dublin from his unsatisfactory tour when he received letters which informed him that he had incurred the king's serious displeasure. His Majesty, so these letters ran, expected his servants not only to do what he commanded, but to do it from the heart and with a cheerful countenance. The Lord Lieutenant had not, indeed, refused to cooperate in the reform of the army and of the civil administration, but his cooperation had been reluctant and perfunctory. His looks had betrayed his feelings, and everybody saw that he disapproved of the policy which he was employed to carry into effect. In great anguish of mind, he wrote to defend himself, but he was sternly told that his defense was not satisfactory. He then, in the most abject terms, declared that he would not attempt to justify himself, that he acquiesced in the royal judgment, be it what it might, that he prostrated himself in the dust, that he implored pardon, that of all penitents he was the most sincere, that he should think it glorious to die in his sovereign's cause, but found it impossible to live under his sovereign's displeasure. Nor was this mere interested hypocrisy, but at least in part unaffected slavishness and poverty of spirit, for in confidential letters not meant for the royal eye, he bemoaned himself to his family in the same strain. He was miserable, he was crushed, the wrath of the king was insupportable. If that wrath could not be mitigated, life would not be worth having. The poor man's terror increased when he learned that it had been determined at Whitehall to recall him and to appoint as his successor his rival and calumniator, Tyrconnell. Then for a time the prospect seemed to clear. The king was in better humor, and during a few days Clarendon flattered himself that his brother's intercession had prevailed and that the crisis was past. End of part 19.